What have trouble between we in this street? A few years later, I sat the Cambridge Senior School Certificate examination myself, and Mr. Cambridge gave me a second grade. I applied for a job in the customs, and it didn't cost me much to get it. I got a khaki uniform with brass buttons and a cap, very much like the sanitary inspector's uniform. Elias wanted to beat me up the first day I wore the uniform. "What'd your mother do to get you that?" he shouted, and I was going for him when Edo's put a stop to it. Edo said, "He just sad and jealous. He don't mean anything." For Elias had become one of the street aristocrats. He was driving the scavenging carts. "No theory here," Elias used to say. "This is the practical." I rarely liked the work. 5. Man-Man. Everybody in Miguel Street said that Man-Man was mad, and so they left him alone. But I am not so sure now that he was mad, and I can think of many people much madder than Man-Man ever was. He didn't look mad. He was a man of medium height, thin, and he wasn't bad-looking either. He never stared at you the way I expected a mad man to do. And when you spoke to him, you were sure of getting a very reasonable reply. But he did have some curious habits. He went up for every election, city council or legislative council, and then he stuck posters everywhere in the district. These posters were well printed. They just had the word "vote," and below that, Man-Man's picture. At every election, he got exactly 3 votes. That I couldn't understand. Man-Man voted for himself, but who were the other 2? I asked Hat. Hat said, "I really can't say, boy. Is a real mystery. Perhaps is 2 jokers. But they is funny sort of jokers if they do the same thing so many times. They must be mad just like he." And for a long time, the thought of those 2 madmen who voted for Man-Man haunted me. Every time I saw someone doing anything just a little bit odd, I wondered, is he who vote for Man-Man? At large in the city were these 2 men of mystery. Man-Man never worked, but he was never idle. He was hypnotized by the word, particularly the written word, and he would spend a whole day writing a single word. One day I met Man-Man at the corner of Miguel Street. "Boy, where are you going?" Man-Man asked. "I'm going to school," I said. And Man-Man, looking at me solemnly, said in a mocking way, "So, you goes to school, eh?" I said automatically, "Yes, I goes to school." And I found that, without intending it, I had imitated Man-Man's correct and very English accent. That again was another mystery about Man-Man, his accent. If you shut your eyes while he spoke, you would believe an Englishman, a good-class Englishman who wasn't particular about grammar, was talking to you. Man-Man said, as though speaking to himself, "So, the little man is going to school." Then he forgot me and took out a long stick of chalk from his pocket and began writing on the pavement. He drew a very big S in outline and then filled it in, and then the C and the H and the O. But then he started making several O's, each smaller than the last, until he was writing in cursive, O after flowing O. When I came home for lunch, he had got to French Street, and he was still writing O's, rubbing off mistakes with a rag. In the afternoon, he had gone round the block and was practically back in Miguel Street. I went home, changed from my school clothes into my home clothes, and went out to the street. He was now halfway up Miguel Street. He said, "So, the little man gone to school today?" I said, "Yes." He stood up and straightened his back. Then he squatted again and drew the outline of a massive L and filled that in slowly and lovingly. When it was finished, he stood up and said, "You finish your work, I finish mine." Or it was like this. If you told Man-Man you were going to the cricket, he would write crick and then concentrate on the E's until he saw you again. One day, Man-Man went to the big cafe at the top of Miguel Street and began barking and growling at the customers on the stools as though he were a dog. The owner, a big Portuguese man with hairy hands, said, "Man-Man, get out of this shop before I tangle with you." Man-Man just laughed. They threw Man-Man out. Next day, the owner found that someone had entered his cafe during the night and had left all the doors open. But nothing was missing. Hat said, "One thing you must never do is trouble Man-Man. He remember everything." That night, the cafe was entered again, and the doors again left open. The following night, the cafe was entered, and this time, little blobs of excrement were left on the center of every stool and on top of every table, and at regular intervals along the counter. The owner of the cafe was the laughingstock of the street for several weeks, and it was only after a long time that people began going to the cafe again. Hat said, "It's just like I say. Boy, I don't like meddling with that man. These people really bad mind, you know. God make them that way." It was things like this that made people leave Man-Man alone. The only friend he had was a little mongrel dog, white with black spots on the ears. The dog was like Man-Man in a way, too. It was a curious dog. It never barked, never looked at you, and if you looked at it, it looked away. It never made friends with any other dog, and if some dog tried either to get friendly or aggressive, Man-Man's dog gave it a brief look of disdain and ambled away without looking back. Man-Man loved his dog, and the dog loved Man-Man. They were made for each other, and Man-Man couldn't have made a living without his dog. Man-Man appeared to exercise a great control over the movements of his dog's bowels. Hat said, "That does really beat me. I can't make that one out." It all began in Miguel Street. One morning, several women got up to find that the clothes they had left to bleach overnight had been sullied by the droppings of a dog. No one wanted to use the sheets and the shirts after that, and when Man-Man called, everyone was willing to give him the dirty clothes. Man-Man used to sell these clothes. Hat said, "It's things like this that make me wonder whether the man really mad." From Miguel Street, Man-Man's activities spread, and all the people who had suffered from Man-Man's dog were anxious to get other people to suffer the same thing. We in Miguel Street became a little proud of him. I don't know what it was that caused Man-Man to turn good. Perhaps the death of his dog had something to do with it. The dog was run over by a car, and it gave, Hat said, just one short squeak, and then it was silent. Man-Man wandered about for days, looking dazed and lost. He no longer wrote words on the pavement, no longer spoke to me or to any of the other boys in the street. He began talking to himself, clasping his hands and shaking as though he had ague. Then one day he said he had seen God after having a bath. This didn't surprise many of us. Seeing God was quite common in Port of Spain, and indeed in Trinidad at that time. Ganesh Pandit, the mystic masseur from Fuente Grove, had started it. He had seen God too, and had published a little booklet called What God Told Me. Many rival mystics, and not a few masseurs, had announced the same thing. And I suppose it was natural that since God was in the area, Man-Man should see him. Man-Man began preaching at the corner of Miguel Street, under the awning of Mary's shop. He did this every Saturday night, He let his beard grow, and he dressed in a long white robe. He got a Bible and other holy things, and stood in the white light of an acetylene lamp, and preached. He was an impressive preacher, and he preached in an odd way. He made women cry, and he made people like Hat really worried. He used to hold the Bible in his right hand and slap it with his left, and say in his perfect English accent, "I have been talking to God these few days, and what he tell me about you people wasn't really nice to hear. These days you hear all the politicians and them talking about making the island self-sufficient. You know what God tell me last night? Last night self, just after I finish eating? God say, 'Man, come and have a look at these people.' He show me husband eating wife, and wife eating husband. He show me father eating son, and mother eating daughter. He show me brother eating sister, and sister eating brother. That is what these politicians and them mean by saying that the island is going to become self-sufficient. But brethren, it not too late now to turn to God." I used to get nightmares every Saturday night after hearing Man preach. But the odd thing was that the more he frightened people, the more they came to hear him preach. And when the collection was made, they gave him more than ever. In the weekdays, he just walked about in his white robe, and he begged for food. He said he had done what Jesus ordered, and he had given away all his goods. With his long black beard and his bright, deep eyes, you couldn't refuse him anything. He noticed me no longer, and never asked me, "So you goes to school?" The people in Miguel didn't know what to make of the change. They tried to comfort themselves by saying that Man was really mad. But, like me, I think they weren't sure that Man wasn't really right. What happened afterwards wasn't really unexpected. Man announced that he was a new Messiah. Hat said one day, "You ain't here the latest?" We said, "What?" "Is about Man. He say he going to be crucified one of these days." "Nobody could touch him," Edward said. "Everybody afraid of him now." Hat explained, "No, it ain't that. He going to crucify hisself. One of these Fridays, he going to Blue Basin and tie hisself to a cross and let people stone him." Somebody, Errol, I think, laughed, but finding that no one laughed with him, fell silent again. But on top of our wonder and worry, we had this great pride in knowing that Man came from Miguel Street. Little handwritten notices began appearing in the shops and cafes and on the gates of some houses, announcing Man's forthcoming crucifixion. "They're going to have a big crowd in Blue Basin," Hat announced, and added with pride, "And I hear they send in some police, too." That day, early in the morning, before the shops opened and the trolley buses began running in Arapita Avenue, the big crowd assembled at the corner of Miguel Street. There were lots of men dressed in black, and even more women dressed in white. They were singing hymns. There were also about 20 policemen, but they were not singing hymns. When Man appeared, looking very thin and very holy, women cried and rushed to touch his gown. The police stood by, prepared to handle anything. A van came with a great wooden cross. Hat, looking unhappy in his serge suit, said, "They tell me it make from matchwood. It ain't heavy. It light." Edward said, in a snapping sort of way, "That matter is the heart and the spirit that matter." Hat said, "I ain't saying nothing." Some men began taking the cross from the van to give it to Man, but he stopped them. His English accent sounded impressive in the early morning.
"Not here. Leave it for Blue Basin."
Hat was disappointed. We walked to Blue Basin. the waterfall in the mountains to the northwest of Port of Spain, and we got there in 2 hours. Man-Man began carrying the cross from the road, up the rocky path, and then down to the basin. Some men put up the cross and tied Man-Man to it. Man-Man said, "Stone me, brethren." The women wept and flung bits of sand and gravel at his feet. Man-Man groaned and said, "Father, forgive them. They ain't know what they're doing." Then he screamed out, "Stone me, brethren." A pebble, the size of an egg, struck him on the chest. Man-Man cried, "Stone, stone, stone me, brethren, I forgive you." Edward said, "The man really brave." People began flinging really big stones at Man-Man, aiming at his face and chest. Man-Man looked hurt and surprised. He shouted, "What the hell is this? What the hell you people think you're doing? Look, get me down from this thing, quick. Let me down, quick, and I can settle with that son of a bitch who pelt a stone at me." From where Edward and Hat and the rest of us stood, it sounded like a cry of agony. A bigger stone struck Man-Man. The women flung the sand and gravel at him. We heard Man-Man shout, clear and loud, "Cut this stupidness out! Cut it out, I tell you! I finish with this arseness, you hear?" And then he began cursing so loudly and coarsely that the people stopped in surprise. The police took away Man-Man. The authorities kept him for observation. Then, for good. 6. B. Wordsworth. 3 beggars called punctually every day at the hospital houses in Miguel Street. At about 10, an Indian came in his dhoti and white jacket, and we poured a tin of rice into the sack he carried on his back. At 12, an old woman smoking a clay pipe came, and she got a cent. At 2, a blind man led by a boy called for his penny. Sometimes we had a rogue. One day a man called and said he was hungry. We gave him a meal. He asked for a cigarette and wouldn't go until we had lit it for him. That man never came again. The strangest caller came one afternoon at about 4 o'clock. I had come back from school and was in my home clothes. The man said to me, "Sonny, may I come inside your yard?" He was a small man, and he was tidily dressed. He wore a hat, a white shirt, and black trousers. I asked, "What do you want?" He said, "I want to watch your bees." We had 4 small grugru palm trees, and they were full of uninvited bees. I ran up the steps and shouted, "Ma, it have a man outside here. He say he want to watch the bees." My mother came out, looked at the man, and asked in an unfriendly way, "What you want?" The man said, "I want to watch your bees." His English was so good it didn't sound natural, and I could see my mother was worried. She said to me, "Stay here and watch him while he watched the bees." The man said, "Thank you, madam. You have done a good deed today." He spoke very slowly and very correctly, as though every word was costing him money. We watched the bees, this man and I, for about an hour, squatting near the palm trees. The man said, "I like watching bees. Sonny, do you like watching bees?" I said, "I ain't half the time." He shook his head sadly. He said, "That's what I do. I just watch. I can watch ants for days. Have you ever watched ants? And scorpions, and centipedes, and congeries. Have you watched those?" I shook my head. I said, "What you just do, mister?" He got up and said, "I am a poet." I said, "A good poet?" He said, "The greatest in the world." What your name, mister?
B. Wordsworth.
B for Bill?
Black. Black Wordsworth. White Wordsworth was my brother. We share one heart. I can watch a small flower like the morning glory and cry.
I said, why you just cry?
Why, boy?
Why?
You will know when you grow up. You're a poet too, you know. And when you're a poet, you can cry for everything.
I couldn't laugh.
He said, you like your mother?
When she not beating me?
He pulled out a printed sheet from his hip pocket and said, on this paper is the greatest poem about mothers, and I'm going to sell it to you at a bargain price. For 4 cents. I went inside and I said,
Ma, you want to buy a poetry for 4 cents?
My mother said,
tell that blasted man to haul his tail away from my yard, you hear?
I said to B. Wordsworth,
my mother say she ain't half 4 cents.
B. Wordsworth said, it is the poet's tragedy. And he put the paper back in his pocket. He didn't seem to mind.
I said, is a funny way to go around selling poetry like that. Only Calypsonians do that sort of thing. A lot of people does buy?
He said, no one has yet bought a single copy.
But why you just keep going round then?
He said, in this way I watch many things, and I always hope to meet poets. I said,
you really think I is a poet?
You're as good as me, he said. And when B. Wordsworth left, I prayed I would see him again. About a week later, coming back from school one afternoon, I met him at the corner of Miguel Street. He said, I have been waiting for you for a long time.
I said, you sell any poetry yet?
He shook his head.
He said, in my yard I have the best mango tree in Port of Spain. And now the mangoes are ripe and red and very sweet and juicy. I have waited here for you to tell you this and to invite you to come and eat some of my mangoes.
He lived in Alberto Street in a one-roomed hut placed right in the center of the lot. The yard seemed all green. There was the big mango tree, there was a coconut tree, and there was a plum tree. The place looked wild, as though it wasn't in the city at all. You couldn't see all the big concrete houses in the street. He was right. The mangoes were sweet and juicy. I ate about 6, and the yellow mango juice ran down my arms to my elbows and down my mouth to my chin, and my shirt was stained. My mother said when I got home,
where you was?
You think you was a man now and could go all over the place? Go cut a whip for me. She beat me rather badly, and I ran out of the house swearing that I would never come back. I went to B. Wordsworth's house. I was so angry my nose was bleeding. B. Wordsworth said, stop crying and we will go for a walk. I stopped crying, but I was breathing short. We went for a walk. We walked down St. Clair Avenue to the Savannah and we walked to the race course. B. Wordsworth said, now, let us lie on the grass and look up at the sky. And I want you to think how far those stars are from us. I did as he told me, and I saw what he meant. I felt like nothing. And at the same time, I had never felt so big and great in all my life. I forgot all my anger and all my tears and all the blows. When I said I was better, he began telling me the names of the stars. And I particularly remembered the constellation of Orion, the hunter, though I don't really know why. I can spot Orion even today, but I have forgotten the rest. Then a light was flashed into our faces, and we saw a policeman. We got up from the grass. The policeman said, what you doing here? B. Wordsworth said,
I have been asking myself the same question for 40 years. We became friends, B. Wordsworth and I. He told me, "You must never tell anybody about me and about the mango tree and the coconut tree and the plum tree. You must keep that a secret. If you tell anybody, I will know, because I am a poet." I gave him my word, and I kept it. I liked his little room. It had no more furniture than George's front room, but it looked cleaner and healthier. But it also looked lonely. One day I asked him, "Mr. Wordsworth, why you just keep all this bush in your yard? Ain't it does make the place damp?" He said, "Listen, and I will tell you a story. Once upon a time, a boy and girl met each other, and they fell in love. They loved each other so much, they got married. They were both poets. He loved words, she loved grass and flowers and trees. They lived happily in a single room. And then, one day, the girl poet said to the boy poet, 'We are going to have another poet in the family.' But this poet was never born, because the girl died, and the young poet died with her, inside her. And the girl's husband was very sad, and he said he would never touch a thing in the girl's garden. And so the garden remained, and grew high and wild." I looked at B. Wordsworth, and as he told me this lovely story, he seemed to grow older. I understood his story. We went for long walks together. We went to the botanical gardens and the rock gardens. We climbed Chancellor Hill in the late afternoon and watched the darkness fall on Port of Spain, and watched the lights go on in the city and on the ships in the harbor. He did everything as though he were doing it for the first time in his life. He did everything as though he were doing some church rite. He would say to me, "Now, how about having some ice cream?" And when I said yes, he would grow very serious and say, "Now, which cafe shall we patronize?" As though it were a very important thing. He would think for some time about it and finally say, "I think we will go and negotiate the purchase with that shop." The world became a most exciting place. One day, when I was in his yard, he said to me, "I have a great secret which I am now going to tell you." I said, "It really secret?" "At the moment, yes." I looked at him, and he looked at me. He said, "This is just between you and me, remember. I am writing a poem." "Oh." I was disappointed. He said, "But this is a different sort of poem. This is the greatest poem in the world." I whistled. He said, "I have been working on it for more than 5 years now. I will finish it in about 22 years from now. That is, if I keep on writing at the present rate." "You just write a lot then?" He said, "Not anymore. I just write one line a month. But I make sure it is a good line." I asked, "What was last month's good line?" He looked up at the sky and said, "The past is deep." I said, "It is a beautiful line." B. Wordsworth said, "I hope to distill the experiences of a whole month into that single line of poetry. So in 22 years, I shall have written a poem that will sing to all humanity." I was filled with wonder. Our walks continued. We walked along the seawall at Dockside one day, and I said, "Mr. Wordsworth, if I drop this pin in the water, you think it will float?" He said, "This is a strange world. Drop your pin, and let us see what will happen." The pin sank. I said, How is the poem this month? But he never told me any other line. He merely said, Oh, it comes, you know. It comes. Or we would sit on the seawall and watch the liners come into the harbor. But of the greatest poem in the world, I heard no more. I felt he was growing older. How you does live, Mr. Wordsworth? I asked him one day. He said, You mean how I get money? When I nodded, he laughed in a crooked way. He said, I sing calypsos in the calypso season. And that lasts you the rest of the year? It is enough. But you will be the richest man in the world when you write the greatest poem. He didn't reply. One day, when I went to see him in his little house, I found him lying on his little bed. He looked so old and so weak that I found myself wanting to cry. He said, The poem is not going well. He wasn't looking at me. He was looking through the window at the coconut tree, and he was speaking as though I wasn't there. He said, When I was 20, I felt the power within myself. Then almost in front of my eyes, I could see his face growing older and more tired. He said, But that was a long time ago. And then I felt it so keenly, it was as though I had been slapped by my mother. I could see it clearly on his face. It was there for everyone to see. Death on the shrinking face. He looked at me and saw my tears and sat up. He said, Come. I went and sat on his knees. He looked into my eyes and he said, Oh, you can see it too. I always knew you had the poet's eye. He didn't even look sad. And that made me burst out crying loudly. He pulled me to his thin chest and said, Do you want me to tell you a funny story? And he smiled encouragingly at me. But I couldn't reply. He said, When I have finished this story, I want you to promise that you will go away and never come back to see me. Do you promise? I nodded. He said, Good. Well, listen. That story I told you about the boy poet and the girl poet, do you remember that? That wasn't true. It was something I just made up. All this talk about poetry and the greatest poem in the world, that wasn't true either. Isn't that the funniest thing you have heard? But his voice broke. I left the house and ran home crying, like a poet, for everything I saw. I walked along Alberto Street a year later, but I could find no sign of the poet's house. It hadn't vanished, just like that. It had been pulled down, and a big, two-storied building had taken its place. The mango tree and the plum tree and the coconut tree had all been cut down, and there was brick and concrete everywhere. It was just as though B. Wordsworth had never existed. 7. The Coward. Bigfoot was really big and really black, and everybody in Miguel Street was afraid of him. It wasn't his bigness or his blackness that people feared, for there were blacker and bigger people about. People were afraid of him because he was so silent and sulky. He looked dangerous, like those terrible dogs that never bark, but just look at you from the corner of their eyes. Hat used to say, "Is only a form of showing off, you know, all this quietness he does give us. He quiet just because he ain't have anything to say, that's all." Yet you could hear Hat telling all sorts of people at the races and cricket, "Bigfoot and me? We is bosom pals, man. We grew up together." And at school, I myself used to say, Bigfoot does live in my street, you hear? I know him good, and if any one of all you touch me, I go tell Bigfoot.
At that time, I had never spoken a single word to Bigfoot. We in Miguel Street were proud to claim him, because he was something of a character in Port of Spain, and had quite a reputation. It was Bigfoot who flung the stone at the Radio Trinidad building one day and broke a window. When the magistrate asked why he did it, Bigfoot just said, "To wake them up." A well-wisher paid the fine for him. Then there was the time he got a job driving one of the diesel buses. He drove the bus out of the city to Carenage, 5 miles away, and told the passengers to get out and bathe. He stood by to see that they did. After that, he got a job as a postman, and he had a great time misplacing people's letters. They found him at Dockside, with a bag half full of letters, soaking his big feet in the Gulf of Paria. He said,
"It's hard work, walking all over the place, delivering people letters. You come like a postage stamp man."
All Trinidad thought of him as a comedian, but we who knew him thought otherwise. It was people like Bigfoot who gave the steel bands a bad name. Bigfoot was always ready to start a fight with another band, but he looked so big and dangerous that he himself was never involved in any fight, and he never went to jail for more than 3 months or so at a time. Hat especially was afraid of Bigfoot. Hat often said, "I don't know why they don't lose Bigfoot in jail, you know." You would have thought that when he was beating his pans and dancing in the street at carnival, Bigfoot would at least smile and look happy.
But no.
It was on occasions like this that he prepared his sulkiest and grimmest face. And when you saw him beating a pan, you felt, to judge by his earnestness, that he was doing some sacred act. One day, a big crowd of us, Hat, Edward, Edoes, Boyi, Errol, and myself, went to the cinema. We were sitting in a row, laughing and talking all during the film, having a good time. A voice from behind said, very quietly, "Shut up." We turned and saw Bigfoot. He lazily pulled out a knife from his trouser pocket, flicked the blade open, and stuck it in the back of my chair. He looked up at the screen and said in a frighteningly friendly way, "Talk." We didn't say a word for the rest of the film. Afterwards, Hat said, "You does only get policeman's son behaving in that way. Policeman's son and priest's son." Boyi said, "You mean Bigfoot is priest's son?" Hat said, "You too stupid. Priest and them does have children." We heard a lot about Bigfoot's father from Hat. It seemed he was as much a terror as Bigfoot. Sometimes when Boyi and Errol and I were comparing notes about beatings, Boyi said, "The blows we get is nothing to what Bigfoot uses to get from his father. That is how he gets so big, you know. I meet a boy from Belmont the other day in the savannah, and this boy tell me that blows does make you grow." Errol said, "You is a blasted fool, man. How you just let people give you stupidness like that?" And once Hat said,
"Every day Bigfoot father, the policeman, give Bigfoot blows, like medicine, 3 times a day after meals. And hear Bigfoot talk afterwards. He used to say, 'When I get big and have children, I got beat them. Beat them.'"
I didn't say it then, because I was ashamed, but I had often felt the same way when my mother beat me. I asked Hat, "And Bigfoot mother? She used to beat him too?" Hat said,
"Oh God, that would have killed him. Bigfoot didn't have any mother. His father didn't marry, thank God."
The Americans were crawling all over Port of Spain in those days, making the city really hot. Children didn't take long to find out that they were easy people, always ready to give with both hands. Hat began working a small racket.
he had five of us going all over the district begging for chewing gum and chocolate. For every packet of chewing gum we gave him, we got a cent. Sometimes I made as much as 12 cents in a day. Some boy told me later that Hat was selling the chewing gum for 6 cents a packet, but I didn't believe it. One afternoon, standing on the pavement outside my house, I saw an American soldier down the street, coming towards me. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, very hot, and the street was practically empty. The American behaved in a very surprising way when I sprinted down to ask, "Got any gum, Joe?" He mumbled something about begging kids, and I think he was going to slap me or cuff me. He wasn't very big, but I was afraid. I think he was drunk. He set his mouth. A gruff voice said, "Look, leave the boy alone, you hear?" It was Bigfoot. Not another word was said. The American, suddenly humble, walked away, making a great pretense of not being in a hurry. Bigfoot didn't even look at me. I never said again, "Got any gum, Joe?" Yet this did not make me like Bigfoot. I was, I believe, a little more afraid of him. I told Hat about the American and Bigfoot. Hat said, "All the Americans not like that. You can't throw away 12 cents a day like that." But I refused to beg anymore. I said, "If it wasn't for Bigfoot, the man would have killed me." Hat said, "You know, it's a good thing Bigfoot father dead before Bigfoot really get big." I said, "What happened to Bigfoot father then?" Hat said, "You ain't here? It was a famous thing. A crowd of black people beat him up and kill him in 1937 when they was having the riots in the oil fields. Bigfoot father was playing hero, just like Bigfoot playing hero now." I said, "Hat, why you don't like Bigfoot?" Hat said, "I ain't have anything against him." I said, "Why you afraid him so then?" Hat said,
"Ain't you afraid him too?"
I nodded. "But I feel you do him something, and you worried." Hat said, "Nothing really. It's just funny. The rest of we boys used to give Bigfoot hell too. He was thin when he was small, you know, and we used to have a hell of a time chasing him all over the place. He couldn't run at all." I felt sorry for Bigfoot. I said, "How that funny?" Hat said,
"You get here. You know the upshot? Bigfoot come the best runner out of all of we. In the school sports, he run the 100 yards in 10.4 seconds. That is what they say. But you know how Trinidad people can't count time. Anyway, then we all want to come friendly with him. But he don't want we at all. At all." And I wondered then why Bigfoot held himself back from beating Hat and the rest of the people who had bullied him when he was a boy. But still, I didn't like him. Bigfoot became a carpenter for a while, and actually built 2 or 3 enormous wardrobes, rough, ugly things. But he sold them, and then he became a mason. There is no stupid pride among Trinidad craftsmen. No one is a specialist. He came to our yard one day to do a job. I stood by and watched him. I didn't speak to him, and he didn't speak to me. I noticed that he used his feet as a trowel. He mumbled, "It's hard work, bending down all the time." He did the job well enough. His feet were not big for nothing. About 4 o'clock he knocked off and spoke to me. He said, "Boy, let me go for a walk. I hot and I want to cool off." I didn't want to go, but I felt I had to. We went to the seawall at dockside and watched the sea. Soon it began to grow dark. The lights came on in the harbor. The world seemed very big, dark, and silent. We stood up without speaking a word. Then a sudden sharp
yap, very near us, tore the silence. The suddenness and strangeness of the noise paralyzed me for a moment. It was only a dog, a small white and black dog with large flapping ears. It was dripping wet and was wagging its tail out of pure friendliness. I said, "Come, boy." And the dog shook off the water from its coat on me and then jumped all over me, yapping and squirming. I had forgotten Bigfoot, and when I looked for him, I saw him about 20 yards away, running for all he was worth. I shouted, "Is all right, Bigfoot?" But he stopped before he heard my shout. He cried out loudly, "Oh God, I did! I did! A big bee bottle cut up my foot!" I and the dog ran to him. But when the dog came to him, he seemed to forget his foot, which was bleeding badly. He began hugging and stroking the wet dog and laughing in a crazy way. He had cut his foot very badly, and next day I saw it wrapped up. He couldn't come to finish the work he had begun in our yard. I felt I knew more about Bigfoot than any man in Miguel Street, and I was afraid that I knew so much. I felt like one of those small men in gangster films who know too much and get killed. And thereafter, I was always conscious that Bigfoot knew what I was thinking. I felt his fear that I would tell. But although I was bursting with Bigfoot's secret, I told no one. I would have liked to reassure him, but there was no means. His presence in the street became something that haunted me, and it was all I could do to stop myself telling Hat, "I'm not afraid of Bigfoot. I don't know why you afraid him so." Errol, Boye, and myself sat on the pavement discussing the war. Errol said, "If they just make Lord Anthony Eden prime minister, we go beat up the Germans and them bad, bad." Boye said, "What Lord Eden go do so?" Errol just heard in a very knowing way. I said, "Yes, I always think that if they make Lord Anthony Eden prime minister, the war go end quick, quick." Boye said, "You people just don't know the Germans. The Germans strong like hell, you know. A boy was telling me that these Germans and them could eat a nail with their teeth alone." Errol said, "But we have Americans on we side now." Boye said, "But they not big like the Germans. All the Germans and them big, big and strong like Bigfoot, you know. And they braver than Bigfoot." Errol said, "Shh, look, he coming." Bigfoot was very near, and I felt he could hear the conversation. He was looking at me, and there was a curious look in his eyes. Boye said, "Why you shitting me so for? I ain't saying anything bad. I just saying that the German's brave as Bigfoot." Just for a moment, I saw the begging look in Bigfoot's eyes. I looked away. When Bigfoot had passed, Errol said to me, "Like Bigfoot have something with you, boy." One afternoon, Hat was reading the morning paper. He shouted to us, "But look at what I read in here, man." We asked, "What happening now?" Hat said, "It's about Bigfoot." Boye said, "What, they throw him in jail again?" Hat said, "Bigfoot taking up boxing." I understood more than I could say. Hat said, "He could get his tail mash up. If he think that boxing is just throwing yourself around, he could find out his mistake." The newspapers made a big thing out of it. The most popular headline was, "Prankster turns pugilist." And when I next saw Bigfoot, I felt I could look him in the eyes. And now I wasn't afraid of him. I was afraid for him. But I had no need. Bigfoot had what the sports writers all called a phenomenal success. He knocked out fighter after fighter, and Miguel Street grew more afraid of him and more proud of him. Hat said, "Is only because he only fighting stupid little people. He ain't meet anybody yet that have real class.
Bigfoot seemed to have forgotten me. His eyes no longer sought mine whenever we met, and he no longer stopped to talk to me. He was the terror of the street. I, like everybody else, was frightened of him. As before, I preferred it that way. He even began showing off more. We used to see him running up and down Miguel Street in stupid-looking maroon shorts, and he resolutely refused to notice anybody. Hat was terrified. He said, "They shouldn't let a man who go to jail box." An Englishman came to Trinidad one day, and the papers to interview him. The man said he was a boxer and a champion of the Royal Air Force. Next morning, his picture appeared. 2 days later, another picture of him appeared. This time, he was dressed only in black shorts, and he had squared up towards the cameraman with his boxing gloves on. The headline said, "Who will fight this man?" And Trinidad answered, "Bigfoot will fight this man." The excitement was intense when Bigfoot agreed. Miguel Street was in the news, and even Hat was pleased. Hat said, "I know it's stupid to say, but I hope Bigfoot beat him." And he went around the district placing bets with everyone who had money to throw away. We turned up in strength at the stadium on the night. Hat rushed madly here and there, waving a $20 bill, shouting, "20-5, Bigfoot beat him." I bet Boye 6 cents that Bigfoot would lose. And in truth, when Bigfoot came out to the ring, dancing disdainfully in the ring, without looking at anybody in the crowd, we felt pleased. Hat shouted, "That is man!" I couldn't bear to look at the fight. I looked all the time at the only woman in the crowd. She was an American or a Canadian woman, and she was nibbling at peanuts. She was so blonde, her hair looked like straw. Whenever a blow was landed, the crowd roared, and the woman pulled in her lips as though she had given the blow, and then she nibbled furiously at her peanuts. She never shouted or got up or waved her hands. I hated that woman. The roars grew louder and more frequent. I could hear Hat shouting, "Come on, Bigfoot! Beat him up, man!" Then, with panic in his voice, "Remember your father!" But Hat's shouts died away. Bigfoot had lost the fight on points. Hat paid out about $100 in 5 minutes. He said, "I have to sell the brown and white cow, the one I buy from George." Edward said, "Is God work?" Boye said to me, "I could give you your 6 cents tomorrow." I said, "6 cents tomorrow? But what do you think I is, a millionaire? Look, man, give me my money now. Now, you hear?" He paid up. But the crowd was laughing, laughing. I looked at the ring. Bigfoot was in tears. He was like a boy. And the more he cried, the louder he cried, and the more painful it sounded. The secret I had held for Bigfoot was now shown to everybody. Hat said, "What? He cried?" And Hat laughed. He seemed to forget all about the cow. He said, "Well, well, look at man, eh?" And all of us from Miguel Street laughed at Bigfoot. All except me. For I knew how he felt, although he was a big man and I was a boy. Wished I had never betted that 6 cents with Boye. The papers next morning said, "Pugilist sobs in ring." Trinidad thought it was Bigfoot, the comedian, doing something funny again. But we knew otherwise. Bigfoot left Miguel Street, and the last I heard of him was that he was a laborer in a quarry in Laventille. About 6 months later, a little scandal was rippling through Trinidad, making everybody feel silly. The RAF champion, it turned out, had never been in the RAF,
and as a boxer, he was completely unknown. Hat said,
Well,
what do you expect in a place like this? 8. The Pyrotechnicist.
A stranger could drive through Miguel Street and just say, slum, because he could see no more.
But we who lived there saw our street as a world, where everybody was quite different from everybody else.
Man-Man was mad. George was stupid. Bigfoot was a bully. Hat was an adventurer. Popo was a philosopher. And Morgan was our comedian. Or that was how we looked upon him.
But looking back now, after so many years, I think he deserved a lot more respect than we gave him.
It was his own fault, of course.
He was one of those men who deliberately set out to clown and wasn't happy unless people were laughing at him. And he was always thinking of new crazinesses which he hoped would amuse us. He was the sort of man who, having once created a laugh by sticking the match in his mouth and trying to light it with his cigarette, having once done that, does it over and over again. Hat used to say,
Is a damn nuisance, having that man trying to be funny all the time, when all of we well know that he not so happy at all.
I felt that sometimes Morgan knew his jokes were not coming off, and that made him so miserable that we all felt unkind and nasty. Morgan was the first artist I ever met in my life. He spent nearly all his time, even when he was playing the fool, thinking about beauty. Morgan made fireworks. He loved fireworks, and he was full of theories about fireworks. Something about the cosmic dance or the dance of life. But this was the sort of talk that went clean over our heads in Miguel Street. And when Morgan saw this, he would begin using even bigger words, just for the joke. One of the big words I learnt from Morgan is the title of this sketch. But very few people in Trinidad used Morgan's fireworks. All the big fetes in the island passed. Races, Carnival, Discovery Day, the Indian Centenary. And while the rest of the island was going crazy with rum and music and pretty women by the sea, Morgan was just going crazy with rage. Morgan used to go to the savannah and watch the fireworks of his rivals and hear the cheers of the crowd as the fireworks spattered and spangled the sky. He would come in a great temper and beat all his children. He had 10 of them. His wife was too big for him to beat. Hat would say,
We better send for the fire brigade.
And for the next 2 or 3 hours, Morgan would prowl in a stupid sort of way around his backyard, letting off fireworks so crazily that we used to hear his wife shouting, Morgan, stop playing the ass. You make 10 children and you have a wife, and you can't afford to go in dead now. Morgan would roar like a bull and beat on the galvanized iron fence. He would shout, Everybody want to beat me. Everybody. Pat said,
You know we here in the rail, Morgan, now.
These fits of craziness made Morgan a real terror. When the fits were on him, he had the idea that Baku, the mechanical genius who was my uncle, was always ready to beat him. And at about 11 o'clock in the evenings, the idea just seemed to explode in his head. He would beat on the fence and shout, Baku, you fat belly good-for-nothing son of a bitch, come out and fight like a man. Baku would keep on reading the Ramayana in his doleful singing voice, lying flat on his belly on his bed. Baku was a big man, and Morgan was a very small man, with the smallest hands and the thinnest wrists in Miguel Street. Mrs. Baku would say, Morgan, why you don't shut up and go to sleep? Mrs. Morgan would reply, Hey, you thin foot woman, you better leave my husband alone, you hear? Why you don't look after your own? Mrs. Baku would say, You better mind your mouth, otherwise I come up and turn your face with one slap, you hear? Mrs. Baku was 4 feet high, 3 feet wide, and 3 feet deep. Mrs. Morgan was a little over 6 foot tall.